It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Milwaukee was once home to a handful of natatoria, or public bathhouses, that attracted over 500,000 visitors each year. We'll learn about the history of those buildings and what's become of them today. First, a bill to raise compensation for people wrongfully convicted of crimes has been reintroduced in the state legislature. Supporters have been trying to pass the measure for years now. The bill has received bipartisan support before, but it stalled in the state Senate in 2016 because some senators opposed efforts to seal the criminal records of people who had been exonerated. Jarrett Adams is an attorney for the Innocence Project, which is focused on exonerating people wrongfully convicted of crimes. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
How you doing? Thank you guys for having me on.
Well, can you tell us how Wisconsin stacks up compared to the rest of the country when it comes to compensation for people when they're exonerated?
It's one of the worst of the worst. I mean, they only beat out the states that don't have compensation at all. And that is saying a lot. You're talking about a $25,000 max for someone, no matter how much time they spent in prison. And the money aspect of it is one thing. But what's troubling is that, you know, no one is considering all of the other collateral damage that it causes. You're talking about people coming home from prison with absolutely nothing, and they're going home. And what is really home? Home is the house of someone else that allows you to live there. So that problem becomes families' problems. It becomes the community's problem, because the person who reintegrates back into society is ill-prepared to do so and doesn't have any compensation or assistance from the states which wrong them.
And how should we think about this kind of compensation? Is it a way to say, okay, here's some help to get you started on your life outside of prison now that you've been exonerated? Or is it a way to say, hey, we got it wrong, we're sorry?
No, I mean, listen, it's a way to say, look, you know, we need to make sure that you are out here and not just out here floating in the wind and becoming a problem for everyone else who has absolutely nothing to do with this. And what I mean by that is, you know, when people are coming home from prison, especially when they've been wrong, you know, there's absolutely no expectation of when they're coming home. It's unlike when you go parole. When you're paroled, you have a parole officer. You may have this. They may have inadequate services, but they have services. When someone is exonerated, they are just released. And when they are released, after that, everything is a roll of the dice. And so it's much more than just saying, hey, we wronged you, this is what we should give you. It's the moral and ethical thing to do when the state has people who are put into office to protect the community and members are reintegrating back into the community and they are ill-prepared to do so.
Are we seeing a movement in other states around the country to increase this kind of compensation?
Absolutely. One of the leading states is Texas. Of all places, Texas has one of the best compensation statutes, and I think that a lot of the country right now is replicating what they have going on, and it's pretty much what's on the bill right now in Wisconsin. I mean, it's basically access for $50,000 a year, plus, you know, the most important thing, in my opinion, is the health care aspect of it, the mental health care aspect of it, you know, the educational aspect of it, because the one thing you want to do is, you don't want to do is, just give a bankroll to someone, because if that person does not understand how to make a living for themselves, then it will be pointless. And so the educational aspect of it is important. The mental health care aspect of it is important because of the post-traumatic stresses that a person deals with while trying to reintegrate and put so much damage in the past.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, he's an attorney for the Innocence Project. We're talking about an effort in Wisconsin State Legislature right now to increase compensation for people who have been wrongfully convicted, people who have spent time in prison and then have been exonerated. Talk some more about the kind of services. You mentioned health care and mental health care. How about things like vocational training, connecting with jobs?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I mean as far as the educational aspect of it. I mean, that's hugely important. And let me be clear when I say this. This isn't the first time this bill has been introduced. And I think that a lot of the stigmas that are attached to people who go to prison are the barriers right now to why it's taking so long to get passed. I have a very hard time believing that if this was a population of a bunch of soccer moms, that this bill wouldn't have been passed already. But because we've been made to believe in society that every person who has a pair of handcuffs on them has to be a bad person, and if they didn't do that, they did something else, we make it easily digestible for the public to not demand what should be a given, and that's people having assistance coming back from such a horrible event.
You've worked with people who have ultimately been exonerated. Talk to them. Do you feel like they feel like society views them as, you know, inmates, just like someone who was convicted of a crime that they actually did commit?
Quite frankly, they just don't know how to feel. They feel angry. They feel upset. They feel exactly where they are, which is in a no man's land. Because again, you have three different people who go in and out of prison. You have people who go there and they are convicted of crimes and they mandatory release out, which means that they serve all of their time and they're released. Either they parole out and they're out on probation for a few years. And then you have those who are exonerated of a crime, proven to not have done it, and they're released. The only one of that group that gets absolutely nothing and there are no setups or anything for them are the exonerated folks. So they just don't know how to feel. They just don't know how to feel. And I am a part of that conversation and a part of that population. Although I was able to make a dramatic turnaround, I am aware that one of the things that allowed me to do this was that I came home with my youth. There are a lot of people who are coming home at the age of retirement with absolutely nothing to retire on.
And as you say, this was your story, not just as an attorney, but as someone wrongfully convicted yourself. What is it maybe in your own story that made a difference that we could hopefully replicate with other people being exonerated?
I have to go back to the mental health care aspect. My family encouraged me to go and seek therapy, but that is a lot easier said than done because, you know, I didn't have a job. It wasn't until I got a job where I was able to have insurance to go and get that therapy. So just imagine for people who are coming home in their 50s, late 50s, early 60s, and they don't have, you know, the physical ability to go get a job. So they don't have insurance, and they never have the opportunity to get the desperately needed mental health care.
Are we seeing people, those people you mentioned in their 50s, maybe even 60, being exonerated after 30, 40 years in prison?
You are seeing a wide range, and usually when a person is exonerated at that age, usually they have served close to two decades or over a decade in prison, and it's something that, you know, if you look at the case of Robert Lee Stinson, you know, Wisconsin, you know, he was compensated. He had to do a special bill to be compensated. So if that special bill was passed through, why can't there be an overall bill to not only ensure that the people who have been injured by the state are coming home to something to be able to put their lives back together, but again, to also take into account of the family members, the community that they reintegrate back into, have the resources to make sure that they're not a burden to the community.
Are you hopeful now that the bill may pass this time in the legislature?
I'm extremely hopeful, and if it doesn't go around this time, we'll be back again. But I also, you know, have to ask myself, why on earth wouldn't a bill like this be passed? And they can't use the excuse of, oh, well, you know, there's one thing holding it up, and that's the records and filling the records. Look, that is trivial. You handle that. You can handle that and deal with that in a variety of different ways. The most important thing right now is that men and women are not coming home to absolutely nothing.
Jarrett, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. And one more thing.
Sure.
I have recently left the Innocence Project, and I am now out on my own. I've started my own law practice.
Okay, thank you. We will fix that on our website. That's Jarrett Adams, an attorney. He's been working over the years with people who have been wrongfully convicted. He joined us to share his take on Wisconsin legislation that would raise compensation for people who had been wrongfully convicted. Right now, if you want to take a bath, chances are you don't have to leave your house. But if you were living in Milwaukee in the late 1800s, You might have gone to your local natatorium. The city was once home to 7 of the buildings which offered bathing, swimming, and other facilities. Our next guest profiled the public bathing facilities for On Milwaukee. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's throw this out to you. Do you have a personal memory of a natatorium in Milwaukee? Was it where you learned to swim, as a lot of people did? Did you grow up near one of those buildings, or do you live near one of the buildings? Now, a different function there now. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bobby Tanzillo is a writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee, where he writes a regular feature called Urban Spelunking. Bobby, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Paint us a picture, Bobby. If we went back in time and went into a natatorium when it was in full swing, what would we have seen?
Well, you know, originally they were built to have sort of a dual purpose, as you said, of being a place where kids could learn to swim or where they could just swim for recreation. But also they had private shower rooms, because most people's houses did not have those kinds of facilities. And there were a few other places in Milwaukee that offered those kinds of services, social centers, neighborhood centers, those kinds of things. But in the old days, I mean, they were packed. And, you know, there are some pictures in the story on the site on Milwaukee that show, like, groups of kids, you know, lining the pool on all four sides and up on the balcony above. And, you know, in the 1920s, there were apparently almost 700,000 people used the natatoriums, which is pretty amazing when you consider that's, you know, slightly more than the population of the city.
And when I think of a city publicly supporting a bath, I guess I go back to ancient Rome. How did this come into existence in Milwaukee in the late 1800s?
Apparently there had been discussions in a lot of cities about this kind of thing, but Milwaukee was one of the first to make it actually happen. And there had been talk going back to basically when the city was first chartered about this, but it didn't really actually happen until the 1880s, and then the first one opened in 1889.
And what was the case people were making to have this?
I think it was just that. It was the fact that people, you know, there was the recreation component, but I think what was really the bigger issue for people was that it was a cleanliness issue, a public health.
A hygiene. And yeah, was there a European background to this?
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I think people probably knew the same things we know, you know, about this. You know, ancient Rome, you know, all these Turkish baths, all these other kinds of baths, they were out there. People knew that they existed. I don't know that there's a direct lineage to it. But, you know, when the first one opened, the newspaper called it a temple dedicated to cleanliness. So I think that tells you sort of what the goal was. More so than kids having a good time diving, it was cleanliness, hygiene.
And this was a big hit, it sounds like. The first one, there ended up being 7 total, right? You talk about how this was built and then they started to spread?
Yeah, they built the first one just sort of on the far west side of downtown on 7th and Highland, where MATC is now. And then that one was so popular that they added a second one, and then which was the one on the south side. That people still tend to think of, even though the building is now gone. The building survived for a while after the natatorium closed, but people tend to remember that one because it was famous as a restaurant that had dolphins swimming in the tank. And then, you know, they just sort of started to pop up, and, you know, then there were a couple added on the north side, a couple more added on the south side over time. And the last one that was built in 1917.
And then these were mainly for the water, the pools and the baths, but they started, some of them had other stuff, a public library in one of them, other facilities?
Yeah, the one on 16th and North Avenue actually had a public library in it, which was unusual. The others did not.
Now describe the buildings to us. You noted a recurring theme, I think, in the style.
Yeah, well, the first one was designed by this guy named Herman Schnetzky, who did a lot of schoolhouses and things like that in Milwaukee, and tended to work in a sort of Romanesque revival style. So that first one looked like that, had the big arches, like what we think of as Romanesque design. But after that, they all sort of became neoclassical with these columns, you know, sort of sturdy looking buildings with these sort of, you know, Palladian columns out front. And they all sort of followed that same theme. And inside, they followed the same sort of thing too. You walked in and they all had the big tank, as they called it, which was the pool right in the center. And then there was a balcony above it that had changing rooms and the showers and all that. And if you look at the interiors of them, they all really follow that. One or two had an extra floor above, but still the same layout, basically.
Talking to Bobby Tanzillo from On Milwaukee, looking at the historical Natatoria of Milwaukee, these bathing and swimming facilities, their rise and fall, which we'll get to in just a bit. I want to bring in a caller, though, at 800-642-1234. Nick is with us in Lancaster. Nick, hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Do you have a memory?
I grew up on the south side of Milwaukee, and I remember my dad taking us to the Natatoria on 10th and Hayes. And I can't remember if it was free or like a nickel, but it was just an awesome place to go. And I'm in my 60s now, and the memory's really there. It was an awesome place.
And you went there for swimming, Nick?
Well, we went there for swimming and, you know, just to hang out and spend time together as a family. You know, I have one brother, and, you know, my dad and my brother and I would go. I don't remember if I learned how to swim there or if I just got thrown off a pier somewhere.
Another popular way.
Right, yeah, Wisconsin way. Nick, thanks a lot for sharing that story. And, yeah, this was a family activity, it sounds like, Bobby, and a social activity for a lot of people.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, from the comments I got after when the story initially ran, tons of people said that they still had the swimming card that they earned when they passed the class, or they had medals that they won at swim meets there. Loads of people said they went with their entire families. What I heard even more was lots of kids went with in a big group from the neighborhood. You know, like 10 kids on a block would just get their stuff and walk over to the NAD, as they called it.
And it sounds like the main purpose changed over time as more people got bathtubs and showers at home. The hygiene was less of the highlight, and the swimming was more of the big deal.
Yes, that definitely did change, you know, by the, you know, after you get through sort of the first third of the 20th century, the focus turns to the swimming more than the hygiene part.
And why did they start to decline even as swimming facilities?
Well, you know, part of it was that the county started to build pools in the parks, which drew some people away. But also, even in the 40s, there were reports that the city was doing that found that, I've had people tell me since that they had memories of this too, that the people who worked in some of the natatoriums were really not very nice, frankly. And so you had a lot of these natatorium workers who were mean to the kids, were sort of short with people, were sort of haughty. And it turned off a lot of people who I think started to find alternate ways to amuse themselves. And then, you know, it really declines in the 40s, then into the 50s, which coincides with television, of course. And again, those public pools that start to be built outside as well.
And Bobby, you'd mentioned one of them was converted into a famous restaurant that had dolphins. And I think our next caller is going to take us there. TR is with us in Madison. TR, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I'm a professional juggler, and in the 80s, I did a show with my brother. We did a lot of things in Milwaukee, and someone told us about the restaurant, the Natatorium. So we went there and introduced ourselves and told them not only were we professional jugglers, but that we had been in Hawaii and we had swum with the dolphins a number of times. And so they asked us if we would do a juggling show for the dolphins. So first we did that. They had a little platform where the trainer would stand on the edge of the pool. And the dolphins were completely unimpressed with human juggling. They spent a lot, they watched for about 10 or 15 seconds, and then they proceeded to squirt us with mouthfuls of water. And then they also, so then we asked the trainer, would it be all right, could we go swimming with the dolphins sometime? And they looked at us with great big eyes and said, you do that? And we said, sure, we've done that lots of times. And which we have swum with wild dolphins in Hawaii, which are spinner dolphins, and they're like maybe 5.5 feet long. These were the ones in the pool were Atlantic bottlenose, which were 12 and 15 feet long.
Oh, wow.
Big, big dolphins.
And how did that go?
They said, well, they had one mask. So my partner had the mask, and we both got in the water with them and swam around. The female was really, really friendly. She would swim right up to you, rub her body against you, allow you to put her arm over you and drag you around the pool. But the more she did that, the more aggressive the male got. And after about 15 minutes, my partner let me have the mask, and I put it on, And as soon as I had the mask on, the male swam right up in my face and opened his mouth and showed me the 66 big pearly white teeth he had.
TR, I'm going to jump in. That's a close encounter there. That was one of the most famous things, that restaurant, Bobby, that used the Natatorium building. What's there now for some of the surviving buildings that used to house the Natatoria?
Well, you know, there are not many that survive. There is one that survived, and it is currently home to a private school. It had been a community center for many years, and then now it's a private school.
And the rest of them have all been demolished, is that right?
Yep, the rest have all been demolished over time.
And you mentioned the response you got. I was starting to look at the comments on Milwaukee and our first caller today. A lot of people have memories of swimming, not always with dolphins, but
right.
of swimming in the
Natatorium. Rarely with dolphins, yes.
And then as you were pitching this idea and talking about it, Bobby, did you get any sense that people would want this sort of thing today? Or is this something a strictly, you know, last century sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, I can't tell. I mean, basically everybody who commented just talked about how much they loved it when they were a kid, you know. There was nobody really said, let's, you know, we should have these again. Although I think there would be, you know, in a city like Milwaukee where you have a lot of kids, and especially in the summer, a lot of kids who don't have enough to do probably that's constructive, you know, it seems like a great idea to have these kinds of places where kids could get together and swim and play games and do things like, you know, not necessarily with pools, but I definitely think Milwaukee needs more places for kids, not fewer.
Bobby, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bobby Tanzillo is a writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee. He was with us for a look back at the rise and fall of Milwaukee's public bathing and swimming facilities, the Natatoria. If you have a story of maybe swimming there or dining at that restaurant or seeing people juggle there, maybe, I don't know, you could share that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I think we got a couple pictures up there, too. One out of five kids aged 5 to 17 speak a language other than English in their homes. That's according to 2016 data from National Kids Count. Multilingual school programs like dual immersion classes address the challenges of teaching students who speak little to no English and others whose first and only language is English. A handful of districts around Wisconsin offer dual immersion classes. The popularity of these kind of classes is rising so much among middle-class families that there's concern it may begin to push out English learners, part of the main target audience for these classes. Connor Williams is a senior researcher at New America's Education Policy Program, and he writes about education. His piece in The Atlantic is called "The Intrusion of White Families into Bilingual Schools." Connor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start with the basics. So what is a dual immersion program? How does it work?
Right. So dual immersion programs are a model of education where kids are taught academic content in two languages. It's straightforward enough. They're immersed in both. And so critically, this allows them to learn each language through the subject, not just as an isolated topic. Anybody who took a high school language course knows that if you go and you're studying verb tenses and just memorizing vocabulary, that's no way to learn a language. So these programs, they actually teach kids how to learn math in both languages, or science, or reading, literacy, all of the different subjects. And the real critical part of the article is that these programs have a lot of different forms, but the biggest fault line is between one-way programs on the one hand, and they serve usually exclusively native-speaking English speakers, and two-way programs on the other. And these are the two-way programs are the really impressive ones that serve integrated populations where the students are about evenly split between native speakers of English and native speakers of the other language in the program.
So make sure I have this right. Say this is a Spanish-English program. About roughly, ideally, half the kids are come from a Spanish-speaking family, are mainly Spanish speakers. The other half, mainly English speakers. They're all learning together in both languages.
That's right. So it's dual immersion because it's two languages of instruction, and it's two-way because you have two different language teams, language subgroups in the classroom. The reason that those are so important and that they work so well is actually a relatively simple math problem, that if you have a class full of English-speaking first graders, let's say, and you have one Spanish-speaking teacher, she's a native speaker, she's really strong in Spanish, there's still only one of her, and that means that when she's not the one doing the talking, it's likely that the class defaults back into English over and over and over in social interactions and all of the learning. When you have two different groups of students who sort of have different language default positions, that means that a lot of their social language interactions are going to start to happen in both English but also in the other language.
Now, before we had these dual immersion programs, or at least many of them, what was the standard? Was it the English as a second language, where the kids who didn't start off with English are kind of taking their own separate classes?
There hasn't been any one standard in the United States over the years. For instance, it's one of the lost bits of history from the United States is that we have a long history of bilingual education that stretches back well over a century in a variety of different settings. In the North Midwest, I'm from Michigan. In the North Midwest, German populations, Dutch populations, Polish populations of immigrants ran their own school systems often that maintained their native languages even as students started learning English. But there have also been other moments in American history where these languages have been seen as a threat, and different regions in the country have swung away from multilingual education and towards English-only or English immersion instruction. Sometimes it has to do with foreign policy. The wars we're fighting at the given moment, and that was a big deal with the ending of a lot of the German bilingual programs in the early 20th century. Sometimes it has to do with shifting politics and economics. California, as a state, went English-only in the late 1990s because there was a sense, this politics around so many Latino immigrants were perceived to be in the state, and there was this wave of trying to make them feel less welcome. So it really has varied a lot by region and by historical moment.
Talking to Connor Williams from New America's Education Policy Program, talking about a bilingual education program called Dual Immersion Education. He says a lot of time the demographics of people using it are changing. And Connor, you visited, before we get into the problems, you visited some functioning dual immersion programs. What did you see? What happens when it's working well?
Well, so I have the luxury of attending one every single day when I drop my children off here in Washington, D.C. I have two elementary school children who are in a really highly integrated two-way dual immersion program. It's nicely balanced between Spanish native-speaking students and English-speaking native-speaking students. So what you'll see, it really does come down to what I was hinting at before. If you're in one of these classrooms that's working well, you'll notice that the social interactions between students, especially across different language groups, will be in both the target language and in English. It's just a matter of, they call them, in the research world, it's called peer effects, that those peer effects of student-to-student interactions being conducted in my children's case in Spanish, that those tend to be really helpful at engaging all students across lines of difference, but also at developing both the languages in that classroom. I did go to some other programs as part of the research for the article, one in Delaware that was Academia Antonio Alonso, which was a really impressive integrated school out there. And I've seen, as part of my work at New America, we go to these schools regularly. The big challenge, frankly, nationwide on these two-way immersion programs isn't selling them at the elementary school level or proving that they work at that level, but finding out how to expand them into middle school and high school. And that's something that a lot of places still haven't figured out how to do.
And another problem is it sounds like these programs are in some ways victims of their own success. And this is a big part of what you write about. They're so popular that it's skewing the demographics of who gets spots in these classes.
That's right. It's very difficult to prove this. It's the kind of thing. So my work involves going around to schools all over the country to talk about how they serve English learners. And educators have been telling me this for 4 or 5 years now. They see this over and over again. They've got this new program. It was rolled out to try to serve a new group of immigrant or English language learner students in the district, and then to bring those students into the broader schooling system where they would be in classrooms with English-dominant kids too. And the demand from the English-dominant families, from privileged families, was pushing these kids out over time. I also look as a white, relatively privileged, English-dominant parent in Washington, D.C., I hear about this on the playground regularly. And in our city, these programs have hundreds to thousands of kids on the wait list for pre-K every single year in the public school system.
And because we base where kids go to school very often on where they live, a changing neighborhood can have the same effect, right? Push this program's popular, people who can afford to move there to take advantage of it, and then what happens?
That's right. And so in D.C., we have a couple of instances of this where there are neighborhoods that have gentrified out, and that's pushed a great many traditionally underserved students and their families out of these neighborhoods, many of whom are English language learners. So as a neighborhood gets whiter and wealthier and more English dominant, then the school does too. We have some open enrollment lottery schools here, and this is the same in Los Angeles, in various other communities around the country, too, where they have the neighborhood problem. They also have some of these open enrollment lottery schools where no matter where you live in the district, you can still go if you're given a seat in the random lottery. The problem is that gentrification patterns are such in some of these communities, D.C. for sure, and also in other places, where folks, English language learner families, are being gentrified out of the entire community. They're not in the district, so they're not even eligible to be in the lottery anymore. And then maybe most critically, and this is actually, it doesn't come as much in the article, but it is happening, is that because they're popular in places where they exist, they're being expanded, and the expansions that are happening in ways that are that tend to be one-way immersion programs for English-speaking kids. And this is in Utah, this is in Delaware, New York City. A lot of the different efforts to expand dual immersion education aren't actually, they're just from the beginning being targeted at English-speaking families.
So I want to talk about who loses out here. Obviously, you were talking about English language learners, who this is in large part devised for, are getting placed out of these schools. How about lower income families with the English speaking families who might want this opportunity?
Absolutely. In fact, this is one of the major challenges. We have this problem right now that the rhetoric around this is very complicated. For instance, it is true that it would be great. It would be better than our current situation. It would be, in fact, optimal if every kid who went through U.S.'s public schools came out multilingual. That would be a great goal to shoot for. It's a goal we should be shooting for. It is also the case that a vanishingly small percentage of American teachers are prepared to actually teach in these programs. We have a very small percentage of our teachers who are actually functionally, seriously, proficiently multilingual. So that means that every time we open one of these and we skew the student body towards the privileged, in the zero-sum game, that means that underserved, underprivileged students are often not getting access. And so then you have this first-order problem. The second-order problem is we really do need English-speaking kids in these programs. It's good for the English language learners, in many cases, the native Spanish-speaking students. It's really good for them to be around native English-speaking students. The trouble is that as that number creeps up to 60, 70, 80, 90% of the kids in a particular program are English-dominant kids, then the program is not going to work as well to produce multilingualism in the long run, and it's going to mean that a lot of English language learners aren't getting access. The problem then, finally, is to your point, if you have then about half of each of these programs should be designated for English-dominant kids, that means that English-dominant kids from low-income families are almost inevitably always going to lose out. So the moment that we start catering these programs to the privileged, it's going to underserve English language learners for sure, and it's probably also going to start underserving English-dominant families who are from low-income backgrounds as well.
Connor Williams is with us, senior researcher at New America's Education Policy Program. We're talking about bilingual schools and dual immersion programs. He writes that the popularity of these programs may be driving out the kids they're supposed to help. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We have some of these schools around Wisconsin. Do you have experience with one of them? As a parent, a student, a teacher there, would you like to send your kid to a school like this if it were available in your area? Would you have gone to a school like this as a kid yourself? Should it be a goal for students to come out of school multilingual? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Connor Williams, senior researcher at New America's Education Policy Program. We're looking at the growing popularity of dual immersion programs in schools where classes are run in two languages, most commonly English and Spanish, but not just that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have experience with this kind of dual immersion program? We have some of them around Wisconsin. Have you taught in one of them? Have you sent your kid to one of those? Do you wish you had something like this in your area where kids learn in two different languages, ideally a mix of kids from the backgrounds of both languages? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. And Connor, you're talking about a shortage of teachers who can teach successfully, thoroughly in two different languages, English and Spanish or whatever the other language is. Is there an effort to get more teachers trained to be able to do that?
Not at a national level, no. The numbers, as I've lately seen them, is that we have, as you said, approaching 25%. It's between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4 of our K-12 students are speaking a non-English language at home. The numbers for teachers are about half that, so it's around 1 in 9, 1 in 10. And then of that one, right, the 10% or so of teachers who speak a non-English language at home, they only about, you can imagine about a half of those are teaching French in high schools or German, or, you know, they're not eligible or available to be starting in these dual immersion classrooms. And that means we just really don't have a teaching force that speaks the languages at the same rates and at the same levels as our students. There are some regional efforts and some local efforts. Our team has been doing some work on that here in New America about different ways to try to train up multilingual paraprofessionals and teachers' aides to become fully licensed teachers, different ways to adjust our teacher licensure process so that they're friendlier to non-native English speakers. There's always the sort of possibility of changing our visa rules for visiting international teachers, although that's a pretty fraught move these days. Financial incentives to get bilingual adults to consider teaching. All these things are out there in the world, but there's nothing that's a big comprehensive effort.
This is resource intensive, but any thought of team teaching one teacher who's really good at English and has some Spanish and vice versa?
Yeah, that's one of the ways that, frankly, these programs have started to develop that way now, where you can double your double the effect of each Spanish-speaking or Mandarin-speaking or French-speaking teacher by having them teach half the day of one class and half the day of another. They essentially get to, instead of serving 20 or 30 first graders, now they can serve 40 to 60 by serving two different classrooms, by sort of switching kids. You do see that sometime, for sure.
I want to bring on a caller now. We have Kathy with us in the Waukesha area. Kathy, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Kathy?
Hello. Well, I began teaching many years ago in a one-way program. It pretty much served students that did not speak English, and then the school district added dual two-way in about 8 years ago, and it is a fabulous program. And as our numbers grow with both group levels, they tend to open up more programs in more schools, and it's a very successful program.
And Kathy,
if you look at the research.
Go ahead.
I'm a reading teacher, and have been doing both languages for many years.
And Kathy, is your district able to find teachers as they open up more programs, make them available for more kids?
Fortunately, yes.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kathy, for sharing that experience. So she sees it as a success, and knock on wood, so far, Waukesha is finding the teachers they need, Connor.
That's great. It's very encouraging to hear. I know Madison runs a number of these programs as well. I've not been to see them, but I have heard of a number of them, including Nuestro Mundo.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kathy, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Jacob on the line in Eau Claire. Jacob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jacob?
When I was younger, it must have been first grade, kindergarten or so, there was a brother and a sister. They were twins, and they were both deaf. And so the school had a translator there, and we had classes just so that way we could communicate with them every day. And so I learned sign language at a young age in school, and then I've been able to teach my own kids that now that I've gotten older and have kids of my own.
Well, that's interesting. And they taught the subject matter, at least in part, in sign language.
Yes, they did everything in sign language with a translator right up there next to the teacher. And then they had classes for us so that way we could learn sign language, so that way the brother and the sister wouldn't feel like they were left out.
Jacob, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Connor, Jacob, it sounds like, still works with sign language, was teaching it to his own kids. Is that part of the point of immersion? Because I've taken a lot of foreign language classes in my life. I speak virtually none of those languages now. The immersion at an early age really does seem to stick with people.
Yeah, we've got pretty good research on this now. That I'm the same as you. I started taking Spanish classes in middle school, and I basically followed the existing English-dominant multilingual pathway in the United States. So you start then, and you take courses forever. You major in it in college and study abroad, and somewhere in there around study abroad, you kind of lock it in for good. But it took 12 years. You know, it took basically the whole of my academic career, starting in middle school and going on. The idea with immersion, especially in the elementary years, is you can get at kids when technical term is their brain plasticity, which is to say that their brains are more flexible. They still have more room to accommodate a second language, and they can build it into how their brains are actually wired. The really exciting and somewhat cutting-edge research on this starts to suggest that because it actually wires kids' brains differently as they're growing up, there's some research to suggest that it makes them smarter and more powerful thinkers in a host of ways that don't have any obvious connection to language. They pay better attention. They're able to really drill deep into a particular task. They can intentionally manage their attention in ways that other monolingual kids aren't as able to do. So, yeah, it's beyond exciting for the parents who get into these programs. The trouble, of course, is making sure that we allocate those slots equitably.
Jacob, thanks for the call. Go next to Gene in Kaukauna. Gene, hi.
Hi. I have two little granddaughters in the Milwaukee school system. They're in a bilingual school. And it is a great idea starting out young. But I think there's a added thing that people don't realize is when they learn it in those schools and they have mixed people, the racial issues are really addressed too. And it gets us, I mean, my granders, they don't notice that. They know difference in color, like a little girl had a different dress on.
Huh. Gene, thanks for the call. Connor, we're starting to run out of time, but is that, being able to work with people from different backgrounds part of the goal here?
Absolutely. This is something you hear a lot about in these programs. They're about building global citizens who are tolerant, who are comfortable with different cultures and different languages. And done well, you can set policies that'll do this. Linguistic integration can actually support racial and ethnic integration as well.
And briefly, Connor, competitiveness. It's a world where we're talking to people who speak a lot of languages.
No question. In the future, for instance, in Utah, where they've been building out more of these dual immersion programs, a lot of them are one way for English speakers. But it is still the case that the conservative lawmaker in the state Senate who put it together was compelled to do it because he was going to China and finding that their degree of multilingualism, the number of Chinese students who knew English, was just off the charts compared to the United States, number of students who knew Mandarin.
We'll leave it there for now. Connor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Connor Williams. He's a senior researcher at New America's Education Policy Program. He writes about education. He joined us to talk about his piece for The Atlantic. It's called The Intrusion of White Families into Bilingual Schools. Still time for you to share your thoughts and your experiences if you've experienced bilingual education one way or another, or if you learned English in a school as a non-English speaker when you came in. Love to hear about your experiences too. You can tell your story. You can email ideas at WPR.org, or you can post over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'd love to hear what you have to say. There is actual snow on the ground in most of Wisconsin now, and it's not too cold to get out and appreciate it. I'm wondering if you are finally getting out and doing some great winter activities, or if you've been doing it all along. There have been a lot of hurdles this year to get out and ice skate for the first time, which my kids tried to do, but encountered long lines on their first try on that first warm day with the frozen pond. But they were ultimately successful. I imagine a lot of people are getting their cross-country skis out for the first time and doing a snowshoeing, maybe. Ice fishing, I think, has been going on for a bit. Want to hear from you. Give us a quick tweet at Central Time WPR. Over the last couple weeks, have you gotten out and enjoyed winter now that the opportunity is really well and truly there? Honestly, my only winter activity so far over the last couple days has been shoveling and dusting off cars. I have not gotten out to enjoy it, but it's been fun finally seeing the kids get out and sled on the tiny little hill at the park across the street or the bigger hill around the corner. So let us know, are you out and enjoying the winter snow and not completely frigid temperatures? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.